And the recordings are posted to our webpage in case anyone is interested in going back. We have several upcoming professional development opportunities, including one more webinar in today's webinar strand available for you, and more information and registration information is available on our webpage, nysrti.org. A copy of today's PowerPoint is also available on our webpage under Professional Development and then under Webinars. At the end of today's webinar, we'll post a link to a very brief evaluation. If you could please take a few minutes to respond to that, we would very much appreciate that. Also, during today's presentation, if you can please use the chat box for any questions or comments that you may have. We are very pleased to have back with us today Dr. Sylvia Linen-Thompson to present our Strand 11 series, Culturally Responsive Instruction and Assessment for English Language Learners in an RTI Model. Today is the second webinar in this strand, and the topic is Culturally Responsive Assessment for ELLs in an RTI Model. Dr. Sylvia Linen-Thompson is an associate professor at the University of Texas at Austin. Her research interests include examining appropriate instructional and assessment practices for English language learners, particularly those related to the acquisition of reading skills and the implementation of RTI. At this time, I'd like to welcome Dr. Linen-Thompson.
Thank you, Molly, and welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us this afternoon for the second webinar in this series. As Molly mentioned, the focus today is going to be on culturally responsive assessment for English language learners. Before we get started, I'd like to acknowledge the U.S. Department of Education, who is funding our project Estrella, which is looking at the implementation of RTI in schools that have high numbers of English language learners, and in particular looking at the ways in which the RTI model might be modified for those settings. Today we're going to have a brief introduction, and then we'll talk about the purpose of assessment, universal screening and progress monitoring, and then discuss other measures that you might use to help you make determinations about English learners' progress and how you might use them. So to get started, just so I have a sense of who you are, if you could just please answer this poll. Okay, so it looks like mostly ESL teachers, but at least one representative of every other group. Okay, thank you. I have one more question for you, again, just so I get a sense of who you are, of what kind of programs you have. What kind of bilingual program do you have in your school? Okay, so it looks like mostly ESL, but some transitional bilingual programs. Okay, thank you. So before we get started, and I'm not sure how many of you were with us last week, so I'm going to go over some of the general ideas that we introduced in the overview presentation. This is our definition of culturally and linguistically responsive response to intervention, and the goal of the projects that we have been working on. And the first one is to ensure that no group of students is over or underrepresented in supplemental or intensive interventions. So it really, our goal is to try to work at having appropriate assessments and appropriate processes so that this is not an issue. And one way that you that we can do that is by taking into account the many factors that we know can impact student performance, progress, and scores on screening and progress measures. So changes in English and native language proficiency and literacy skills over time. So, you know, we'll talk about this today. So how are you tracking that growth in that in students' knowledge? Determining or paying attention to the quality, quantity, and features of prior educational experience. And even though this is the session on assessment, we're going to touch on that briefly because those things do impact assessment scores. And then imprecise and or biased assessment instruments. So those are some of the topics or some of the issues that we'll talk about today. So these, I think, are the common issues and things that we're still seeing in many schools, and they might be issues that you have at your schools as well. So one is that according to universal screening data, more than 20% of ELLs in a given grade qualify for Tier 2. So this over-identification of students for Tier 2 continues to be an issue, particularly when only literacy benchmarks are used. And although it might seem that it's okay to over-identify students if they're going to be getting the support they need, then you know, we might think, well, if they're going to get it, if they catch up, then they'll get out and everything will be fine. However, if the students could have gotten the same level of benefit from remaining just in the general education classroom or in Tier 1, and maybe had gotten other advantages like being exposed to higher level language, then it really is not a positive thing for the student. The other thing to think about is, or another common issue, is that according to the progress monitoring data, more than half of the ELLs in a given grade are not reaching benchmark. Right, so if they're not growing at the expected rates in Tier 2, you know, what might be the cause or what are some of the issues that we could examine that could address that? And then finally that your current screening and progress monitoring assessment batteries do not provide a comprehensive view of literacy skills or identify ELLs who are at risk for later reading difficulties. So we still have with ELLs the issue of underrepresentation in special ed in the lower grades and overrepresentation in the upper grades. But when it comes to RTI, it's the first issue. So we still have an overrepresentation of ELLs in Tier 2, and often that begins their track into Tier 3 and then special education. So here is just the assessment framework that we are all familiar with and the different kinds of instruction and the processes that we use. And one of the things that I should say is in the model demonstration project where we're looking at RTI implementation in schools with high numbers of English language learners, we expect RTI to look very much like it does for anybody else, right? So we would have all the same steps. However, the difference would come in the problem solving and how we think about children's growth and the rate of progress that they're making. So it's not intended to be a parallel program or a parallel framework, but rather how within the framework that you have for your school do you make minor changes in order to better serve the English learners in your school through the RTI program. So here's an example of a school that we've been working in. And if you look at these numbers, this is 1 year's data from kindergarten to third grade, beginning, middle, and end of the year data. And the dotted lines, the bottom one is about 15% and the top one is 25%. So, you know, this is the kind of data we would love for schools to have where, you know, the number of children being identified. These are the percentage of children being identified for Tier 2. You know, we would like for more children to exit at the end of the year like they did in first grade. But in overall, they're maintaining an adequate percentage of kids that they're identifying. However, the reality is that more of the schools that we see look like this, where the percentage of students qualifying for Tier 2 exceeds even a generous 25%. And it tends to get worse, as in school A, sometimes it tends to get worse as the kids progress in the grades instead of getting better. And other times you see, like in school B, a jump. They seem to be getting better by second grade, and then third grade, you know, it spikes again. And so we're trying to examine, or one of the things we're doing is examining why this is happening. And one of the things I'll point to you is if you see at the bottom that one problem that's common in schools that have bilingual programs, in both of these schools, the children are getting Spanish instruction from kindergarten to second grade and are being assessed in Spanish. And then in third grade, the assessment turns to English. And so you can say, oh, well, there's a spike in third grade because now they're being assessed in English, where before they were being assessed in Spanish. And so definitely that's something to consider. But other times it has to do with just the types of assessments. So if you look on the right-hand side, what they use at third grade is the Flynn-Cooter at the beginning of the year, a different measure in the middle of the year, which predicts performance on state accountability, and then they have the state accountability test. So, again, that many different kinds of measures isn't productive for determining student progress. The other thing that we think about, because so many times our interest in our data is on those percentages, so because we're still learning so much about English language learners, and again, that growth in English and Spanish over time, one of the things that we're looking at is at the individual patterns of students. So one of the groups that we have, I mean, these are some of the patterns that we have found in our data. So the first one is never in Tier 2, right? So these are your average students. They're doing well from the beginning to the end. They're never in Tier 2. The next one is early entry into Tier 2. So they might be in Tier 2, maybe in kindergarten and first grade, but they exit by the end of first grade, and they don't come back in. The next one is early entry into Tier 2, but late, or I should say later exit. So these are students, again, that are in Tier 2 in kindergarten, first grade, and in first grade, and they exit in second grade and then stay out for, you know, we don't have very long data up to fourth grade, but up till then we know that they're staying out. Then we also find another group of students that seem to do well at the beginning, and they don't enter into Tier 2 till second grade, and then sometimes, as you saw in that data, not till third grade. And so, again, if the reason is because of the change in the language of assessment, that's an easy, understandable fix, right? You can attribute it to the assessment. But if there isn't a change in the language of assessment, then, you know, that is something to be concerned about. Why is this child suddenly not doing as well as they were doing? Is it just because the content got harder or the measures are more profound? Did they not develop strong enough foundational skills? Or is it something else? And the next one is in and out every year, right? And this this is actually, we've seen this for about a third of the children. So at least once or twice every year, they qualify for Tier 2. And so these are children that might benefit from Tier 2 and get strong enough to exit, but then either over the summer or just, you know, after the middle of the year when maybe content gets a little bit harder, they drop again and enter again. And then the final one is always in Tier 2. So every single assessment point, they're in Tier 2. Now, if we start thinking about these possible individual patterns, you know, we could probably be pretty sure that the first two, never in tier two or early entry and early exit, those are kids we don't really have to worry about, right? They're probably, you know, well, the never in tier two, we know those kids are fine. But let's say the early entry to tier two and early exit, those are kids that maybe just hadn't had a lot of experience with literacy and just needed the sort of that really intensive systematic instruction to catch on, caught on, and now are fine. The same thing, we can be pretty sure that the in and out every year and the always in tier two are children that probably have a greater amount of difficulty and maybe even a disability. So those are kids that if we look at their pattern, we can pretty much know that they're going to have something else. But it's the two middle ones, right? The early entry to tier two and the late exit and the late entry into tier two that are problematic. One of the things that we're really looking at is that third group, the early entry to tier two and late exit, because although data from monolingual students has shown that students who don't exit by first grade from tier two tend to stay in tier two, we think that it might be a different pattern for English language learners because they are learning in two languages. So that the fact that they stay at least once or twice in tier two into second grade may not necessarily be indicative of a learning difficulty or disability, but rather just that it's taking them a little bit longer because of the two languages. So that's something that we're exploring and hope to have more information soon about what that might be able to predict. So, again, the factors that we know may affect Tier 2 placement, language proficiency continues to be an issue, opportunity to learn, the quality of previous instruction and language of previous instruction. You know, if you still have issues, if you have high mobility, or not even high, but just mobility in your school, and children are coming in and into your program from a different kind of language program, I mean, that's something that you definitely would want to consider. And then the quality of previous instruction, and then obviously learning difficulties and disabilities. So one of the questions about quality of previous instruction has to do when you get children that are new immigrants. And so for those children, there's definitely the issue of language proficiency if they don't have very well-developed English skills. But it's also hard to know about the quality of their previous instruction. So, you know, if you know that children come from, you know, have refugee status or come from conflict areas, you know, you can be pretty sure that they have had interrupted schooling and that, you know, that you might need to start from the beginning and still watch the rate of growth. But I'm going to share with you some data. This is some international reading achievement data, and just to show you that even children who go to school consistently often don't get very good schooling even when they get instruction in their first language. So this is a percentage of students who could not read a single word in this group of studies that was done in countries in Africa, in Latin America, in English and in their home language. So you can see that even children, and these were second grade students, and so you can see that even after 2 years of schooling in some of these countries, 80% of the children could not read a single word. So even if children have been in schools, that doesn't mean that they have developed any kind or adequate literacy skills. So I would say for many children, unless they were in private schools or were from higher SES groups in other countries, you know, you can probably assume that their literacy skills are minimal even in their own language and that you would have to start from very basic, so just learning sounds, learning to decode, all of those foundational skills, and that to take that into consideration when you are assessing them. So here is another question before we move on. In what language do you assess students? for universal screening and or progress monitoring. Okay, well, it looks like everybody obviously assesses in English, and a few of you assess in some other language groups. Okay, thank you. So let's talk a little bit about the purposes of assessment. So again, here is the typical use of assessment in RTI, and I particularly want to pay attention to the database decision making, because those are the kinds of reasons or the uses of the data that we collect for RTI, right? So it's to determine student progress, whether they can return to core instruction only, whether they're going to continue with current instruction, whether we're going to change their instruction, increase the intensity, or refer to a child study team. And those are the reasons, or those are the most common uses of assessment data for RTI. But we also think that, especially with ELLS, we need to think about other things that we can do, whether, you know, we might able to just be able to identify the children who need extra instructional support in the classroom rather than a tier two intervention. Monitor their progress in the classroom, but and also determine instructional priorities. I don't think that we as often, especially for tier one, think about how we might need to change our instruction in tier one to better support ELLS who maybe aren't meeting benchmark, but don't necessarily need tier two either. So, you know, what is there more that we can do in the classroom to support those students? And then the other part is for at the school level, you know, one of the things that we've been working with in the schools is to determine priorities for support and intervention. And so, in you know, those vary by school, and they're, you know, in one school, they had poor results in first grade, and so decided to emphasize that kindergarten and first grade for a couple of years, and that has changed their numbers and the trajectories for students. In another school, it was children getting stuck, if you will, especially the English learners, in with fluency. They just couldn't quite get to those fluency benchmarks. And, you know, both of those things, and then how they're allocating support. That school C that I showed at the very beginning that had, you know, those pretty nice trends in terms of percentage of kids going into tier two, they put a lot of resources into the beginning, into the early grades. So they had two reading interventionists. They had one that was bilingual that focused only on the ELL students, and the other interventionist focused only on the English language students, even though, you know, and the bilingual interventionist provided support in both Spanish and English. And so they really worked at making sure that there were parallel resources for all the children. In other instances, we don't see that level of parallel support, even when there's large numbers. If you only have a few students, it wouldn't make sense. But if you have large numbers of ELLS, then it really makes sense to make sure that you have the support, not only the human resources, but also the material, so that you have good intervention programs that are appropriate for English learners that attend to language in addition to the literacy skills. So in terms of choosing linguistically appropriate, most of you have the English Immersion or English as a Second Language program. so to use English language and literacy development skills is appropriate. I didn't ask, but if you're not measuring language in some way or have a way of monitoring that, that would be maybe an important process to add to your assessment. So all data can be useful. I know a lot of times when you have second language learners and you're only assessing in English, there's a concern that you're missing out on data when you don't assess in the first language. And while you might, as you saw from the previous data that I showed for some of those countries for recent immigrants, sometimes it wouldn't necessarily help because the children don't have literacy skills in their first language anyway. Is it helpful to know if they know anything? Yes. But the important thing is that the interpretation may vary when assessing English language. So if you know you're only assessing in English and that's their second language, then you can't expect the same benchmarks as for an English monolingual student, right? You would hope to get them there, but you can't, and you also can't assume that because they didn't meet that benchmark that they necessarily need tier two, right? And that's sort of where the rub is with RTI, is that it doesn't give you clear guidance about what it is the child needs. Is it just more language instruction? Do they first need to develop some English or have some opportunity to be around English so that the literacy data is more valuable or more valid? And so those are the kinds of decisions that you need to be thinking about. The language of, so it's whether or not you're assessing in the first or second language, the language of instruction, length of time in the United States, and how long they've been in schools in the United States. If they've been in your school since kindergarten and now they're in second grade and you're not seeing a pattern of improvement, then that is cause for concern. But if they just got here, then that's a different story. The other part is changes in curriculum. We talked a little bit about this last week. If there's a change in curriculum or a change in the language of instruction, while English monolingual students might have enough language resources to sort of fill in gaps, a second language learner is in the change, doesn't get explicit instruction, for example, in phonics or, even in phonological awareness and in sort of that systematic introduction into English. Those kinds of changes can affect them much more than an English monolingual student. So part of what you need to think about is, do you have, and what we'll be talking about today is, if we're going to start using, if we're going to say, well, just depending on a benchmark, a literacy benchmark, whether it's DIBELS or AIMSWeb or, something else, and we're going to use other factors, do we have a systematic process for addressing these factors, right? So it's not just a matter of, let's look at all this other data, but let's think about the implications and how we're going to integrate it so that it makes sense and it's giving us the information that we need. So here are some of the ways that we have been thinking about that process. And the first one has to do with the database decision making, because that's where we find that a lot of these decisions get made. So a lot of it is, what we would typically expect from literacy data. But we also think that it's important to consider the language proficiency. Are you monitoring language proficiency and development in addition to assessing literacy skills? Formally, informally, is there some way to determine if children are learning English? Assure that students understand and use academic language. And then part of the language is also the adequate vocabulary and their syntax use, because though we know that if they haven't developed appropriate English syntax, that can interfere with their ability to comprehend text, even if they're able decoders and fluent readers. So, you know, thinking about how language can impact their scores is going to be important. And then the data inform when and how to introduce literacy instruction in English. Or if you're already teaching them in English, whether additional instructional time is better used to enrich or to remediate. So, and what that means is if we start thinking about spells and who they might be and their scores on the literacy, you know, and if we have some more information about our students and we know enough about them, we can make decisions about, well, you know, they seem to pick up things quickly in the classroom, so they are able to learn. They have a good rate of progress. So even though they didn't meet the benchmark, they might be better served staying in the Tier 1 classroom where they can continue to grow, as opposed to going into Tier 2 where they might learn those skills but are missing out on rich language instruction. Other students, if you know that they're struggling in the Tier 1 classroom and aren't getting as much benefit, then remediation in a Tier 2 classroom might be a better choice. So, I mean, those are the kinds of conversations to have and the data that you would need to start to differentiate this process beyond just looking at the benchmarks. And, you know, the goal is to obtain sort of this complete picture about the children's language and literacy skills, you know, and considering their educational history. But again, the critical part is the last point here, which is the decision rule should clearly articulate how students will be supported to ensure language and literacy success. So if you decide not to put a child in Tier 2, or if you are going to put them in Tier 2, then what other support are they going to get in terms of building language? So, you know, these should be clearly articulated so that, A, it's consistent across students in terms of the kinds of support that you provide, and so that then when you're documenting progress or lack of progress, that you have clear reasons or clear rationales for supporting the decisions that were made. And so that's what this next slide talks about, is the routines and procedures for decision-making must be documented to ensure consistency and identify the additional factors that are considered when making decisions about student placement and intervention. And we're going to talk a little bit about this. And I know oftentimes we hear, well, with ELS, you need to collect all this extra data or this extra information. And I would say that what you need to figure out, and part of it is because we don't have clear data, empirical evidence, about which ones are the most useful or not, and I know that probably isn't very helpful to you, but I mean, but it's the truth, right? So you need to think about what decisions or which of those factors help you make the best decisions about the children in your school. And I think when you're talking about ELS with the number of languages they can come from and the number of different situations, you know, it's great to have sort of this national level data and ideas about that, but what it comes down to is what makes sense in your school. So to have, you know, school and grade level data and procedures for making decisions is going to be critical, especially if your population has been changing in recent years. You know, I know a lot of you, if you're implementing RTI, do data reviews by grade level. But that's where a lot of the problem solving within the teachers and the interventionist comes in terms of looking at those child level factors that could impact decisions about whether to put them in Tier 2, whether to keep them in Tier 2, whether to think about what other support might be more beneficial for that student. And the same thing for for the school level data, you know. So identify issues in the vertical alignment of curricula and determine if subgroups of students are benefiting equally. So both of these things, I think, is to help you determine, and again, kind of maybe going back and thinking about those different patterns of students. You know, if you have some L's that are consistently doing well, how are they different from the ones that aren't? You know, is it the country they came from? Is it the language? You know, what are, can you find some patterns that can help you determine if subgroups of students, all subgroups of students are benefiting equally? So in terms of universal screening, we can talk about the quality and quantity of language and literacy instruction again, and think about the measures that are being used. So the first question always is, are they valid and reliable for ELLs? And I know that's not always possible, but, you know, I think we're doing a much better job at determining which measures have been validated and are reliable for English learners. That demonstrate diagnostic accuracy for predicting learning problems. I think that's the part that's more problematic. We still don't have good measures that discriminate when it comes to English learners between those students who have a learning disability or difficulty and those that are just in the process of learning English. So at what point does that difficulty become severe enough that we can say definitely it's a learning problem. And, you know, the variety of sources we already talked about. So more sources isn't always better. You know, so really think about what the additional data sources add. Do they help you discriminate? So, you know, I'm not a fan of assessing or just adding data for the sake of adding data because it's not always useful and it can be confusing to the decision-making process. So as you're thinking about what data sources or information you're going to add to help you better identify students, think about what they're adding and do they help you discriminate among students? Is there something there that, as you look at your student population, that helps you? If you are able to look across languages, and then the other important part, which is critical, and I think the most important data that you need, is to determine current performance, ability to learn, and rate of learning, because those are the things that RTI is meant to identify. That's what it's meant to help you. And then distribution of skills across languages and over time if you're working in a bilingual program. Okay, we have a question here that says, if I have a fourth grader who is an L and I know from a running record that the child is reading at a level for second grade, should the school be giving a universal screener on the grade level like all the other students? Some of the students are just guessing to complete the assessment and frustrating. Can I give them a lower grade assessment? I think that, yes, I think definitely, because the purpose of universal screening isn't just that they meet the benchmark or not, but where are they? What skills do they have, you know, and what don't they have? So that then you can pinpoint instruction, right? So assessment, the purpose of assessment is to inform instruction. It isn't just to place students in Tier 2 or not. So, you know, if the students are scoring so low on whatever measure that you're using because it's too far above their ability and their level, then keep working backwards until you find the place where they are. What do they know? So can they read words, or can they read a second grade level passage but not a third grade? And that will help you then pinpoint where instruction should begin for that student. There's someone else typing, so I'm going to wait a minute in case it's related to this slide. The question is, where can I find any specific universal screening test, example, DIBELS? Is the rest of that, there's a website that used to be part of the RTI for Success that is also a, I think now it's under intensive instruction, but if you put in RTI for Success, you still can find it, where they have a, and you guys might know about this already, where they have where they evaluate different progress monitoring and screening measures. And one of the things that it tells you is they have a space where it tells you who it was normed on. So you can see specifically which populations it's been used for and whether the benchmarks and other the benchmarks that they provide are include English learners or not. Now, that doesn't mean that you wouldn't want your English learners to reach those benchmarks. I mean, I'm a very strong proponent of, you know, we want these kids to get to the level where they're on par with English monolingual students. But I think part of what the purpose of this talk is to not automatically put them into tier two, right? It kind of goes back to that point about ability to learn. Children who are able to learn and just haven't had opportunity, and if you see that they are doing well and they'll pick up information quickly, those students are better served by staying in your tier one if that's a good program, right? Because they're going to pick it up. Tier two, while it provides very explicit instruction, it's taking them away from the higher level language that they also need. Right, so those are the kind of the two things you're sort of balancing. If a child needs explicit instruction because they're not learning in the general classroom, by all means, if they don't meet the benchmark, then that's the better placement. So that's what we're talking about here, just a more nuanced approach during the data meetings of looking at students, their performance, their ability, and then making decisions rather than just like, oh, they didn't meet the benchmark, they go to tier two. Because we know that there's all those factors that we talked about that can impact their scores that are not necessarily reflective of their ability. Okay, this is tricky because the universal screener used also on ELF makes an organizer possibly believe this means they can put fifth graders on second grade level and have them take a fifth grader level benchmark screener when we already know they are a grade or two below. Okay, I'm not... So let me maybe clarify that point. So if you have a fifth grade student, I would say you use the universal screener for fifth grade, right? They're not going to pass. They're not going to do well. But the fact that they can't do well on a fifth grade level screener because they may read at a second level, I think you child's needs, right? That child needs. And that's what you want, right? So that you can target the instruction they receive. You know, with the idea, because the idea of Tier 2 is always to accelerate learning, so hopefully they eventually catch up, right? So they don't pass the fifth grade, then part of determining what they need instructionally is to keep working back so that you know where they are instructionally and can begin instruction there, right? Because we want instruction to be at their independent or instructional level. So we have to have that information. And then the idea is that you increase or try to accelerate their learning so that they can eventually catch up. So that would be the goal. Yeah, the whole Common Core and the testing is challenging. So it says, what is your advice for ELFs in New York that are having to master the Common Core and assessed on the ELA after a year in the country on grade level rather than their instructional level? And I would say that, I mean, that's not very much time for, we know, everything we know about second language acquisition tells us that 1 year isn't enough time. To develop enough English, especially if they come in, if they come in at first and second grade, that might not be a problem. It's those third, fourth, and fifth graders and older students for whom this, especially if they haven't had exposure to English and don't have literacy rates, literacy in their own language, then that becomes problematic. If you have to assess them, I guess you do. But that doesn't take away from the decisions you make in terms of instruction. If you can't read a fifth grade level passage, a text, then having to do that over and over isn't going to prepare you. You're better off going into a text you know and working up to it. And many new students. The benefit that older students have is that if they don't have a learning difficulty, they can pick up language and a lot of skills, rather quickly if they're provided intensive instruction. So I think it's easy to do. It's not easy. I shouldn't say that. It's doable, but it has to. You have to kind of work at it. So I'm just going to go back to Stephanie. So work back using this benchmark screener, yes, so that you can find that instructional level. And yes, many of the students have interrupted education. And for those students, it might take longer. In terms of your policy at the state, I think that's something you have to work. I know that people at the state level know the data and the research around how long it takes to acquire language. I think one of the goals of Common Core is to have high expectations, which I know we all agree with. But those of us that have been in the classroom know that it's, high expectations are great, but you still have to give the child time to learn. Especially if they're fifth graders and they don't know how to read in any language. So while they can make great progress in a year, they may not be able to reach a grade level in a second language after just 1 year. And I think those are the kind of conversations you would need to have with your state in terms of what kind of accommodations might be appropriate for those students. I'm going to move on. These are all great questions, and we'll have more time at the end. But please do continue to ask questions as we're going along. And just one more thing for Tracy. I think I would go back to the ability to learn and the rate of learning.
Hi, folks. It appears we lost the audio for Dr. Lennon Thompson. Just bear with us for a moment, please. I'm trying to get her back on the line. Okay. Dr. Thompson, please call in again. Dr. Thompson, can you please call in again? Okay, folks, just bear with us.
Hello? Can you guys hear me now?
Yes, you're coming through fine now. Thank you for calling back in.
Sorry, I thought I was just talking away all by myself. Sorry about that.
All right, we're back. You can pick up.
Okay, I'm just going to... I think we had just moved on to progress monitoring and sort of tying it in. I mean, you can see that it's many of the same considerations for English learners in terms of types of measures. And then for those of you that have transitional programs, assessing in two languages, especially for progress monitoring, we have had a lot of success in our schools with assessing in both English and the first language. And rather than overburden the assessment process, alternating languages at each progress monitoring location has worked well because you get sufficient measurement points to tell whether the student is making progress in both languages without adding any more assessment periods. The second part that I was talking about here, sort of going back to the conversation that we were having about benchmark testing, is that while you do want to have grade level benchmarks and, you know, then work backwards to find the instructional level, when it comes to progress monitoring, there's two kinds of progress monitoring you can do. And the first one would be mastery monitoring, which basically is assessing the children on what you're teaching. So if we go back to the example of the fifth grader at the second grade level, you know, one of the things that you would want to do as part of your progress monitoring is assess whether they're learning those skills that you're teaching, even though they're second grade level. But also, you know, at least once every couple of months, you would want to do a grade level progress monitoring, right? So that you can see if they're making progress towards those grade level skills. So you do want to monitor both of those things. So now you can see, though, where with English learners, it might start to get a little complex in terms of progress monitoring if you're progress monitoring in multiple languages, and then you're also doing sort of a mastery monitoring and the grade, you know, the outcome level, the grade level monitoring to see how they're going. So, you know, those would be the considerations. And so in terms of determining if to reduce assessment but still have good progress monitoring data on the student, you know, what you would do, I would say that for the younger students, that the two languages, if you're teaching in both languages or if you have a bilingual program, would be more important. For older students, I think the two levels are more important in terms of instructional levels. So are they making progress on what you're teaching now, and also are they making progress towards grade level benchmarks? So, you know, again, as I said, you always want to kind of keep track of that. And so if you do that some of the time, then you'll see whether they're making progress or not. So here's, it kind of goes, this part of goes back to what we were talking about, the individual profile. So as you look at these trajectories, based on your progress monitoring data, do they make sense? You know, is literacy developing in the way we would expect it? Are they developing the skills that they need? And is there sufficient continuity? Do they provide enough information to discern performance patterns, right? So is that something that you're looking at? And then finally, even though, you know, we don't always want to, but we have to, are the measures predictive of performance on high-stakes reading assessments, right? Because that's why we're implementing this, is so that we can determine if students are making the kind of progress, or, you know, end of sixth grade, or, you know, whatever other, you know, accountability measures you have. And the other part is to, if you don't already, is to review the movement between tiers. And this kind of goes back about whether it's appropriate for all subgroups of students. So is supplemental instruction resulting in an appropriate percentage of students meeting expectations by the middle or the end of the year and exiting tier two? So we have put that number at 61 to 71 percent of the students. And that's what we're seeing, and it's based on what we're seeing in the schools that we're in. And are there inappropriate patterns reflective of instruction or of measurement issues? So again, we would expect all students, you know, to eventually exit tier two. Again, especially at the beginning, if we're thinking about this as a prevention, as a process where we're preventing difficulties. And it, with older students, it, you know, it's more of a remediation process. But, you know, again, if we go back to those students that have interrupted education or just are behind because they come from one of those countries from the chart I showed earlier where even though they were in school, they didn't learn very much, you know, we would expect those students to make good progress with systematic and explicit instruction and a lot of English language development support, right? So it has to be sort of those two things together. And the older students, like the younger ELs, you know, should exhibit that pattern if they don't have a learning difficulty, should exhibit that pattern in which they are develop those foundational skills or decoding skills fairly quickly. And the comprehension might take more time because that's dependent on vocabulary, and vocabulary learning takes time, right? So, you know, if we know those, that's the case, and that's what the research tells us, and, you know, we can begin to think about, you know, appropriate patterns and appropriate length of time that we should give children in terms of opportunity to learn. So this, again, is just an example of, you know, the tier between movements. Again, what we see here is not, you know, you can see in school A that we do have a lot of children in the lower grades exiting. You know, it's low at the beginning, it's high in the middle, drops again at the end of the school year. And so we want them to exit, but what we really want for them is to exit and stay out. So let's talk a little bit about other measures. And the first question is, as I mentioned before, is why use other measures? Why would we want to gather all this information, and how, and more importantly, how are we going to use it to make better decisions and to provide better support for students? And the first one is we know that there is a relationship between language and literacy, right? When we look at all the data for bilingual students and English learners, we know that students that have better language skills, you know, as a group, tend to have better literacy skills. They tend to grow more. They tend to do better. However, that relationship between language proficiency and literacy achievement is not well understood when we start looking at individual students, right? And so what that means is that even though as a group, when we look at averages, you know, the relationship is clear, but then when we start looking at individual children, we have some children that maybe don't have very high language skills, but still do fine on literacy, and other children that are more proficient in English and do worse on literacy. So that's the part when we say it's not well understood, that what I'm talking about. And so, you know, it might make sense to think, well, if they have sufficient English skills and they're not doing well on literacy, then wouldn't we apply the same considerations that we do for monolingual students? And I would say that definitely that would be a cause for concern. Not that it would be exactly like a monolingual student, but that you definitely want to follow that child more quickly. And then, as we spoke before, many benchmarks are not known for ELLS, and we know that there are factors outside of school that impact opportunity to learn. I'm going to back up because there was a question on the progress monitoring, on how frequently should we progress monitor on grade level. I would say, depending on how often you progress monitor, I would say every third or fourth time. So, other data. So, we've talked about this a little bit already in terms of students' educational history. So, the extent of educational opportunity in L1 and L2, and language and literacy trajectories. You know, get as much information about the students. And I would say, to me, this kind of information, especially the educational opportunity, is a starting point in terms of letting me know that they had an opportunity to learn, yes or no. Right, because if they've had an opportunity to learn and haven't learned, then that tells me something about their ability to learn and their rate of learning. If they haven't had an opportunity to learn, then that tells me the first thing I have to do is to see, you know, by providing intensive instruction or doing dynamic assessment to determine if they are able to learn, right? And if they are able to learn, then, you know, and I'm providing instruction and I see that rate of growth, then, you know, that's a very different student And I might not, again, I might put them in a tier two for literacy if they're very far behind. But I might say, oh, you know what, these students really need to focus on building their English because they're picking up literacy skills. And what they're going to need is that English so they develop vocabulary because that's what's going to impact the comprehension. Right? So it's almost also a little bit of long-term. What do these students need to get us to those goals, those long-term goals, which is reading with comprehension on grade level? And if you've kind of mastered the decoding, then what's going to impact your reading comprehension and ability to read at grade level is vocabulary and having word-building strategies, building background knowledge, because we know those are the things that impact comprehension. So where are children going to get that? What's the best setting for them to get those skills? The other thing is when we're thinking about children from different language backgrounds, and even just for the foundational skills, is to really think about differences in language and, you know, their ability, you know, in cross-linguistic transfer. So, you know, as you see here, there's a lot of different languages that have different writing systems. Some of them, like Hindi, are alphasyllabic, so that means that that the base unit for the phonological unit is a syllable. Others are alphabetic. You know, languages like Chinese and are logographic, so the word is the basic unit. And then vocabulary. So one of the things to think about as you have students from, you know, multiple language groups like you have in New York is, and when thinking about even like something as basic as decoding skills, is to look at this. So you looking at this might expect, you know, the students that speak, you know, German and Swedish and Latin and French, well, I don't know why they even have Latin, but, you know, any alphabetic language to pick up the alphabet a lot quicker, to maybe pick up decoding a lot quicker because they're learning some new sounds. Some will overlap, but the alphabet is the same. For any of the other languages where they have the different writing system, you know, these children have to start with just learning the alphabet, right, and recognizing those letters. In some cases, they might have to learn to read in a different direction from what they're used to, right? So that's going to be a different emphasis for those students. So those students might need a lot more time just with recognizing the alphabet. Now, throw in working memory difficulties, that might take even longer, just like our English monolingual kids that have learning difficulties and have working memory or just memory issues. You know, it takes them a lot longer to learn the alphabet and to learn to associate the sounds with letters. So those are the kinds of things in terms of differentiating instruction, but also in terms of thinking about assessment when you assess these students. Is this a new script for them? Are they just seeing these types of letters for the first time? Are they having to understand, you know, that each letter has a sound instead of it being a syllable or a whole word, right? And, you know, they've already sort of have a different approach to print. So, you know, just kind of think about those things and how it might impact their assessment scores. And next time we have a webinar, we'll talk more about how it impacts instruction. And then, like I said before, definitely vocabulary for older students is going to impact comprehension. But it might also impact fluency rates for some of these students if they're slowing down because, you know, for them, reading a text in a language they don't know, even if they can decode, is like reading a word list, right? They're not making meaning as they go along. So it might impact their scores as well. So those are just some things to think about in terms of how coming from a different language group might impact the assessment. And so some of the things that are helpful, again, as I mentioned earlier, one of the things you might want to do is really think about how what makes sense in your school district, right? What are the growth patterns how are students doing, you know, and how might that help you understand the data and make better decisions about students. So, you know, to definitely look at your school and district for past performance, and again, looking at these subgroups of kids, who are the kids that have been successful? What were their, you know, are some kids that maybe didn't meet benchmark go on to be successful? What were their scores? How are these similar or different from the students? You know, looking at class means and grade expectations, and then comparing them to similar peers, right? So one of the things that is often suggested for English language learners is to not compare them to the monolingual English peers, but to other L's. And that is helpful in terms of, you know, when we think about language proficiency. But, you know, the point that I think is important is that that is useful for making decisions about, you know, what kind of support we give children. But our goal is always for them to meet the benchmarks because we know that's what they need in the long run. So it's not to substitute other benchmarks for the English, the ones that we have for English monolingual students, but rather just a way of making better decisions in terms of identifying the support that students need. So, and so if you're going to use other data, you know, whatever it is you decide to use, whether it's class, you know, school performance or class means or benchmarks for similar peers, the important part is to make sure that the routines and procedures for decision making are documented to ensure that consistency when making decisions about student placement and intervention. And again, to always have the goal of getting them to, you know, just grade level. As the ultimate goal. So I have another section, and I just wanted to stop here briefly for questions. I maybe will go on to the writing and then come back, because we'll have another period for questions at the end. So one of the things that we've been working on, so one of the challenges when talking about using language performance and monitoring language is that people always ask, well, what are good language measures? And the reality is that we don't have good measures of language proficiency, especially like for progress monitoring, right? There's things you give at the beginning and the end of the year. You know, you might even be able to have some kind of, you know, something you could give three times a year. But oral language is hard to measure and to measure especially broadly, right? We can measure sub-skills like syntax, those kinds of things, but not just vocabulary, which is what people are interested in. So one thing that we've been looking at is writing, which is the other expressive skill, right? So in terms of language, speech and writing are both expressive skills. So we are looking at writing as a window to language development. And, you know, one of the things we want to know is writing taught explicitly? Is it a daily activity in the early grades? And what types of information can be extracted from writing samples? So that's the part that we've been looking at. And I just will share a little bit of how that's been helping us. So one of the things that we've done is we give children, as part of our project, the Stanford English Language Proficiency Test, and that has a writing component. And that test just has a holistic scoring that goes from 1 to 5. And so we took some of our students and classified them as low writing scores, which was a 2 or 1 on the two writing samples, or a 2-2, and then average, which was 4-4. And then we had a group of students that had already been identified with dyslexia. These are second grade students. And so one of the things we wanted to do, well, does word count, just knowing how many words they write, help us? And so what you can see there is that when looking at the standardized measure, at the beginning of the year, the students that had low writing scores and dyslexia look very similar. But when you look at the spring, there's a huge difference. So the students with dyslexia really made no growth at all over a whole year in terms of how many words they wrote, whereas the students who had just low writing scores were writing about 30 words more by the end of the year. So, again, that's indicative of just the rate of learning, right? One group didn't change at all. One group changed dramatically, even though they started out looking very similar. The average students, no matter what measure we use, they always came out ahead. So one of the things to start thinking about is, well, how can we tell during the year if they're making growth? So we started this year, with this data, we were just looking at their language, at their journals, because journals is something that teachers already do in the classroom. And so, these are the examples from the Stanford, from the English Language Proficiency. So this is the student, a student who has dyslexia. And so you can see, you could probably read that the bunnies wanted the flower. Then a girl, she run the bunnies, and the bunnies eat some leaves, and they were happy, right? So, if you read bilingual, you can kind of tell. So some of the things we see in there is the use of Spanish phonology to spell. There's a very basic story, but not very well elaborated. This is the example of a student that had low language proficiency, and so you can see in terms of spelling, a lot of the same, a little bit better, but not very much. There's two bunnies, and they're eating flowers. Then the girl said, "Don't eat my flowers." Then the bunnies ran away. Then the girl put a basket to the flowers to protect them, her flowers. So the bunnies, they're eating something else now, right? So again, story a little bit more elaborate, but in terms of spelling, not very clear. And so this is an example of the high-level students. So you can see they're completely different from the other two samples. Once upon a time, there were two little bunnies that were eating flowers, and then a girl... mine is very small, came and scared the little bunnies, but then they came back and eated some leaves, and the girl did not scare them away, right? So even though there's still some spelling errors, it's a lot better writing overall. So having looked at this, that we decided to look at journals, and I'll just share very quickly some of the examples of what we found. And part of what we were trying to find is, are there specific measures that give us the best information or that help discriminate, not even the best information, can help discriminate between, the students that we know are identified and those that just had low writing skills. So you can see the first column is words written, so how many words they wrote. And you can see that that doesn't even discriminate among the three groups, right? Because the low-writing children, and this was this interesting phenomenon we found, they write a lot. They write a lot of words. But if you look at words spelled correctly, they don't get very many of them right, to where the average students, they may write fewer words, but they're getting more of them correct. And then the students that were already identified, they write almost as many words as the average student, but they get very few correct. So related to that is correct word sequence. And we wanted to use correct word sequence because that's what's used in writing CBMs. And so, again, that's something that classroom teachers might be familiar with. Unfortunately, because the students that have the low writing ability still make so many mistakes, they're not very different from the children with dyslexia in terms of correct word sequences. And then another thing we looked at was how many unique words they use, and because that's indicative of vocabulary and how many different words they use. And you can see that that also wasn't very indicative. And so here are some examples of what we found. So again, this is the student with dyslexia. The other thing we were looking at is we wanted to see whether their errors are due to Spanish phonology. So, you know, if it's something that they're just, you know, using the linguistic resources that they have to complete a task they're being asked to do. And then we also wanted to see whether they move towards English approximation. So these are still errors, but now they're not depending on Spanish phonology, but rather trying to use what they know about English phonology. And obviously the last step would be for them to have conventional spelling. So as you can see here, this was a student that had been identified with dyslexia. A lot of errors still, you know, almost 70% was the fewest errors they had out of all of their writing. Most of them still using Spanish phonology, which at this point is still, you know, what they're depending on linguistically. And so, you know, these are over time from the beginning of the year, from September to about January. So there's very little change over time. This is an example of a student that had started, that was in that low writing ability. So again, you can see not much change in the total number of words or even unique words. But if you look at the percentage of errors, they went from 90 and, you know, were reducing drastically, I mean, gradually. And then also they didn't start depend as much on Spanish phonology at the beginning of the year. But if you can see in the third data point, now they're moving to almost half and half in terms of errors being due to Spanish phonology and to English approximations. And then other unique errors were just things we couldn't quite place in either one of those categories. And again, compared, this is a student that was a high level. Again, you can see fairly consistent, very few errors, and, you know, at least twice all of the errors were English approximations. So they're not depending as much on their knowledge of Spanish to be able to write in English. So they've kind of made that transfer in terms of awareness that, you know, there's this different phonological process I have to use. And I can tell you that across all the samples, vowels, short, long, are controlled, were the source of the largest number of errors. So again, something that instructionally can be addressed fairly easily. So in terms of possible implications of that, you know, one of the things we're trying to do is identify normal trajectory for bilingual students. So if you're a second language learner, what's normal development for you? And we're still working on discriminating between students with learning and language disabilities and students with just low language proficiency, and to better understand the intersection between second language acquisition and learning disabilities. So this year we're collecting more data across three grade levels to kind of test these different measurements to see if they actually help us discriminate among different levels of students and students with disabilities and those that just have low language proficiency in particular. So thank you, and we have a little bit of time for more questions if you have any. The data that I just presented, the writing data, is something that we're actually getting ready to publish. So hopefully it'll be available soon. But if you're interested, I can send them to you. I guess we can ask Molly about a way, if you're interested, okay, I think the other one is about emailing the charts.
I can email the charts. If you send them to me, I can send them out to the participants.
Okay, yes. Molly said that she can send them out, so I will get them to her. Any other questions?
Looks like we have one person typing. I'm going to post the survey for everybody. And I would like to thank everybody for hanging in there during our little audio blip. Appreciate it.
Sorry, yes. Yes, you can contact me regarding the charts with any questions. My email, I think, is at the very end of the presentation, so you guys will have it. Oh, maybe not. Oh, yes, it is on the very last slide. Has my email.
And everybody knows this there on our webpage.
Yeah. Well, thank you all for joining us this afternoon, and apologies again for the little audio glitch. And hopefully I'll see some of you again in 2 weeks when we talk about instruction.